Despite the fate's attempts at it, we're not even late. We're actually a minute early. My guest, Stephen Luke, has been with us before. This is a survival podcast episode, but it's also an episode of the Bitcoin Breakout. We're going to be talking about a lot of stuff today. And I actually got Steve's application to have him back on before some really interesting news that's come out. So I'm sure we'll dig into things like the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve. And maybe even some stuff on stablecoins, because I kind of called what's about to happen. I think about 3.5 years ago, I said that they would pull stables under the banks and push it out to the whole world in an attempt to defuse inflation for a time. That seems to be on track as well. We've got a lot of other things we're going to be talking about today. Institutional strategies, more and more institutions getting involved. I'm sure we'll talk about things like BlackRock adding their own Bitcoin ETF to their model portfolio and a ton of other stuff, because Steve is just an awesome dude. We'll even probably talk about some things outside of the spaces of Bitcoin as well, because he's into a lot of other cool shit. So we'll have him on in just a minute. Before we do, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsors day number one today is Start9 Private Servers. Kind of fits perfectly for today. I didn't do it on purpose, though. It just came up in the rotation for today. With Start9, you can run your own Bitcoin node. You can run your own Lightning node. You can also run like your own private messaging service. And you can have access to all your files from anywhere in the world across the Tor network. So everything is private and encrypted. And no one else can like access your data or shut you out of it. If you think this is going to be one of those things that's really too technical, Jack, it's not really that hard. You plug it in, you follow the instructions, you install apps on your phone, and you configure those apps for most of it. There's a little bit of a learning curve with setting up a Lightning node and, you know, balancing things on both sides of liquidity and all, but that's the case no matter where you do that. All the rest of this stuff is really super easy. And remember, Jesse Markowitz from the TSP community, you can hire him to help you set things up if you really feel that you need to. But I don't think that you will. Next up today is K9 Academy from Fortress K9 with Joel Riles. You know, a lot of you guys own dogs. In fact, I would say probably the most popular animal in the whole TSP community is the dog. And dogs can be wonderful. Dogs can also be a problem if they're not properly trained. You know, you get the dog to protect your animals and then they eat them, or they chase them around, or they jump on everybody. Hey, learn core obedience with Joel and you'll be able to take your dog to any level you want after that. But it all starts with core obedience. Learn more at canineacademy.us. And with that brief intro, let's bring our special guest on, Stephen Luke. Welcome back to the Survival Podcast and the Bitcoin Breakout.
Always a pleasure, man. Happy to be here. Loved chatting with you last time. And, you know, Bitcoin is a very kind industry to be in, because it always gives you something interesting to talk about. It does not move at slow speed, and so much has changed since we spoke last.
A lot has changed, and there's been some real monetary policy shifts and institutional investment shifts. You want to kind of lead off with some of the stuff that's going on there?
Yeah, so I think, like, just to paint the picture, the story of the last year, 8 months, whatever you want to say, it's two things. It is the spot ETFs, which launched, and this is as far back as the early 2024 period.
Yep.
They ramped all year. And then you have the Trump election victory. You have the Trump administration, you have the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve, and you have all the other actions in regards to Bitcoin that this administration has taken. And I mean, these are just massive stories that each part of it will take years to play out on its own. That doesn't mean you don't see short-term impacts. It just means I don't even, like, the ETF adoption story, we're not even halfway done, in my opinion. Like, we're still relatively early in what has been the most successful ETF launch of all time. And, you know, the only reason people aren't talking about that is just because something even more significant came over the top, which is the administration committing to a strategic Bitcoin reserve, which both exists today, and conversation of future buys. We'll get into that topic, I'm sure. I've spoken to many people very close to the issue, and we have enormous confidence those buys are coming. There will be incremental purchases. There is almost no doubt that that will happen. So just, I mean, so much has happened. And, you know, the net result of all these changes, it's just that it has really taken Bitcoin to the next level. It's just really been something that has, I think, leveled up Bitcoin in the eyes of so many. And, you know, a lot of people have, like, maybe we'll talk about this as well, but like, oh, well, you know, Bitcoin, it's freedom money, it's self-sovereign money. So why are we excited about, you know, oh, why is the government buying it or these ETFs or financial companies? And I understand that objection. But the thing most people, I think, should realize is that these events cause 100 times more people globally to look into Bitcoin, to own Bitcoin for themselves. They're huge adoption events that drive the average person to finally take a look at this thing.
Yeah, agreed. And I do think there was kind of this flat fall after the strategic reserve announcement. And I'm interested in what your thoughts on why that's the case are. I think it's because, one, it was somewhat already priced in.
Yeah.
I also think that the other part of it was that people expected, like, buying to happen right away. And they're like, well, we have all this Bitcoin. We basically stole from Ross Ulbricht and a few others. And we're going to just move it from one bucket where we could sell it to another bucket where we say not to sell it. But there was another piece to that EO, and it was that we will continue to buy. There's been members of the administration saying we're looking to buy a lot. And there was also this concept, though, of revenue neutral. In other words, if they use some funds that were already there that were maybe saved from Doge activity or something. But I saw something I thought was actually a really cool idea. You know, we have millions of government employees running around spending money.
Sure.
And I don't mean on, you know, the transgendered opera in Ireland or whatever. I mean, like, on meals and things like that. Somebody said, wouldn't it be revenue neutral if we just made all of the government employees use a credit card that had Bitcoin back? And I was like, how much Bitcoin could the U.S. government stack doing that? Because I do get crap from the libertarians in my audience and the anarchists in my audience. Because, like, you're rooting for government to steal money to buy Bitcoin. I'm like, man, government does what it does anyway. Like, I look at this more like being a weatherman. Like, is it good for me if the government stacks Bitcoin? Yes. End of story. I'm not influencing their decisions or anything. But I do think that maybe the reason it fell flat is because there was no buy immediately with it.
You nailed it. Yeah, there's maybe one other factor, but I think you nailed the big one. So why was there this drawdown after the SBR announcement? One, the version where they just hold the Bitcoin, that was priced in, right? So I'm not saying the SBR is priced in. I'm saying them not selling was priced in. So we got that. Okay, that hit expectations. But then what wasn't priced in is future buying. However, they didn't do any immediately. And now this is a really interesting topic. And what I will tell you is that the market does not believe they are going to buy right now. Okay. It does not. The average, if you went to Wall Street, if you went to Fidelity, if you went to, like, most of the money in the world and you asked them, is the Trump administration going to buy more Bitcoin? Yes or no? 90% of people would tell you no. They don't believe it. That is completely wrong. I think they're not close to the issue. They don't have the facts. I think if they had the facts, it would be almost 100% the opposite way. There is a 90% chance they will buy Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that. So it is the market is in disbelief about it. And that's fine. That's an opportunity for those of us who know that that's coming. These are, I think, just tremendously discounted opportunities. So that's a lot of the landscape. The one other piece that's missing is that you had this massive stock market sell-off at the same time. The S&P 500 was down 10%, Google, Nvidia, 30% down. Bitcoin just got dragged down with the rest of assets on tariff panics. So it was just, there were no immediate buys to keep it up. And then there was all this forcing function pushing it down. And so, fine, it's an opportunity. That's what I've been telling my clients. I run a Bitcoin private wealth firm. I'm telling everybody this is one of the best risk-adjusted opportunities you're going to see all year on Bitcoin. I mean, these fears will roll over. These buys are going to come, and there will be a race, in my opinion. Capital will be racing to come buy Bitcoin and take a position as soon as that first buy happens. I'll make a prediction.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as they announce the first buy, even if it's only like $100 million, even if it's small, the price will rally immediately and it will run higher for months. You just need the first buy. And I think you see that within 2 months.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think that's kind of when we look at a four-year cycle, about when we would start to see that second uptick in the cycle anyway. This feels a lot like 2017 to me.
Yeah.
With that parabolic runaway in the second surge, with a lot more reason for it to actually happen next time. Like
Correct.
A lot more reason for it to happen. I also wonder, do you think maybe some of the bigger money in the space is poo-pooing this a little bit to buy more time to leverage more into this? Because I think if they sell $10 million worth of shit coins, because they've also got those, and use that, even if it's like that small of a thing, I think that like the minute that happens, it's going to be like, holy crap, they're really going to do it.
I agree. They could literally just, and this is something I think they will do. So what I think one of the easy, okay, let's actually talk about, let me answer what the revenue neutral thing is, and it'll lead into this next point. So one of the key aspects on that executive order is that they want to do revenue neutral purchases. And so you had a great idea of what if we had everybody buy it on credit cards, and that would work. That would absolutely be a revenue neutral purchase. Let's talk about what that is and why they said it. Why did Trump say that? He said it because if it isn't revenue neutral, they have to requisition Congress. And he does not want to go through Congress. It's cumbersome. It's lengthy. He's saying, look, let's just look at all the options where I don't have to bother with Congress. And those are the ones we're gonna work on right now. That doesn't mean nothing's going to go through Congress. The Bitcoin Act is getting co-sponsors. There will be those efforts, but they're longer and they're slower. Mm-hmm. And so what Trump's doing and what the administration is doing is they're looking for ways to avoid it. So that's why revenue neutral is important, as well as they don't want the criticism of you're spending taxpayer money on Bitcoin. You know, it's just a fight they don't want to have. And I get it. You just avoid that whole issue. It's messy. Most people don't understand Bitcoin. I would be fine with it, but I get it. You know, so they're avoiding that. And so they're looking at all these ideas, right? And there's a ton of them. There's so many they could do. It's a broad landscape. And like you said, like credit cards and changing cost structures and these things are all in that bucket. Now, so on your comment of them selling some of the crypto in this crypto stockpile, absolutely. And I think this is one of the first moves. So here's what they do. They look at the crypto strategic stockpile or whatever it's called, and they say, hey, you know what? $300 million of this are stable coins. Why are we holding stable coins? We don't need to hold stable coins. These are just dollars. There's no reason for us to do it. Actually, the interest from them is flowing to other companies.
Correct.
Why are we doing that? There's no reason for that. So we're going to sell the stable coins and we're going to buy Bitcoin. And you know what? We've got $100 million of Binance coin in here. We're an asset. Why are we holding foreign digital assets in an American reserve?
Yeah.
Let's sell all the foreign assets and buy American assets, right? This is a really easy talking point. And so I think they sell the overseas crypto. They sell the stable coins. They probably even sell the wrapped Bitcoin and buy Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got like a $500 million purchase there. You know, you got a nice little buy. I think that's easy for them to do.
$500 million, and that matters. That'll get some attention.
So I think that is like absolute low hanging fruit for them, and they don't even have to piss off the Ripple people or the Solana people, because you know what? There's only like $10 million of that stuff in there anyway.
Yeah.
So they keep it. It's American. We're gonna sell the stable coins, the Binance coin. We're gonna buy some Bitcoin. That's buy one. I think
that's Barron in Trump's ear going, don't sell the shit coins, father, until I dump my bags. <You know>? So, yeah, I think you're dead on with that. You know, you mentioned the stable coins.
Yeah.
And I think it was 3.5-ish years ago that I said my gut was sooner or later the United States is going to drag stables under FDIC or under the banks in some way, legitimize it, push it out to the world, and in doing so, you spread the M2, M3 out, and you diffuse inflation some. And they'll do it because they'll have to, because they're at an end game with the dollar. And I was called all kinds of names for that. I was mocked for that. Sure looks like that's coming.
That 100% is coming, and I'm going to echo your earlier point, is you need to differentiate me, like you said, like a weatherman predicting what will happen versus me saying what I think should happen. Am I, you know, is it my stance that, oh, we need to extend dollar dominance around the world? Like, no, I mean, I'm not, that's not the horse I'm riding, but I'm here to tell you what the guys are going to do, and they do want that, and it does make sense for them. So you're 100% right on the money. Many people didn't see this coming. I was with you years ago. I've written papers, short papers on, this is a no-brainer for the U.S. Like, I'm not saying, like, you know, I'm a Bitcoin guy. I'm doing the Bitcoin thing, but I'd be shocked if the U.S. doesn't do it. Why is it such a no-brainer? Because when you export dollars around the world, right? So the world demands dollars. They want dollars. And so the U.S. is the only entity that can supply those dollars. And so how do they supply the dollars? Well, they have to issue debt, which costs them something. And then they have to, and that creates the dollars. They issue the dollars off that and they send them. Stablecoins are this sort of alchemy that they've figured out where instead of taking that process, they get someone that basically buys the debt. They don't have to pay the interest to them and they send dollars overseas. The dollars are really just treasuries. They're turning treasuries into dollars.
Correct.
They can't do that currently. It is a new function. And so the interest, they don't have to pay anybody on the stable coin, right? Like if they were to, you know, or that money recycles into the issuers, or that interest goes to Bank of America, or it goes to these like public private entities, right? So it's a really elegant way for them to push dollar dominance around the world. It creates way more buyers of U.S. debt, buyers of U.S. treasuries, and it helps Trump with his very vocal goal of trying to wrangle the deficit. Like if that's your goal and you want to try to get the interest payments down, stablecoins are a fantastic way to do it. And they're going to, right? You know, I've said for a while, I'm not like a stablecoin maxi. I'm not like, that's not my thing. But if you're asking me to tell you, okay, what's the best innovation out of this whole crypto space? Well, it's Bitcoin by far and away. You know, is there anything else? Well, stablecoins. That is the only other thing which has succeeded. Just on a success level, everything else is junk. I mean, it hasn't gone anywhere. It has no market adoption. Stablecoins are here to stay. They're not going anywhere. And, you know, the supply is there's probably going to be trillions of dollars of them. So
there's people out there that are full on purists that hate stablecoins, too.
Sure.
And I don't, because I run a business and I have a cash flow cycle and I have certain things that cannot be a volatile currency in the short term.
Sure.
Right.
I cannot
take orders for a physical product if I were shipping these swords, which I'm not. But if I were, right, if I was shipping this and I'm taking orders in Bitcoin and if I'm taking orders in Bitcoin, I have to manufacture that product and Bitcoin takes a dump in the interim between when I take that order and when I order the steel.
Yep.
I'm going to lose my ass. Like, this is one of the things I think people don't get. Like, when is everybody's going to go on a Bitcoin standard. If you're running a payroll or an inventory-centric business, you are not going on a Bitcoin standard as in all Bitcoin and only Bitcoin because it does not make sense. It's also that every piece of accounting software that every business is using is wired to use the dollar. So that's what they're going to do. But if you have a stable coin kind of cooperation, then a person with a device in their hand has everything they need to conduct business in either dollars or Bitcoin and to convert dollars to. Once I go, that's a long-term bucket, boom, it's done. And I think the other thing people don't get is we live in America and we bitch about the devaluation of the dollar because we see it and we have to live with it. But if you were living in another country,
right, so much worse.
It's and you, so were, much. You were holding Lebanese pounds or Vietnamese dong or Laotian kips or something like that, you know, the Indonesian rupee. If you were holding any of that shit, the dollar looks pretty freaking good, doesn't it?
Yeah. So exactly. And that's the thing I always say that people don't get is like, you just have to understand that it's useful for people. These are useful things. If you're in Argentina and you try to buy US dollars on the black market, you're paying a 15% markup and the banks only let you get a couple thousand dollars, right? Like there are people in other countries that it's a real lifeline. And you could say, hey, well, you should use Bitcoin. You should do this or that. And I mean, yeah, in a perfect world, that'd be great. But guess what? Like, they have the freedom to choose, and that is helping them fight government overreach in their country. So you know what? It like you deal with it, right? It's fine.
Yeah.
It's useful. There's ways you can issue stable coins against Bitcoin collateral. That's something cool you might see later on. Where actually Bitcoin, because all a stable coin is a financial asset that maintains the same purchase price, right? Like in some denominated terms, right? You could collateralize that whole system instead of with treasury bonds with Bitcoin, you know, and people have ideas for that. Maybe we end up in a world where there is this stable coin, it's stable against some value, but it's all Bitcoin collateral underneath it, right? So like, you know, take a step back and zoom out and realize that there's a lot of different ways to do this and a lot of different environments that people operate in. Either way, like just coming back to, it's going to be a big story this year. Prepare to hear more about it. Prepare to see the U.S. Treasury embracing it and prepare to see it being a major economic tool in the hands of the Trump administration. Bitcoin will too. They're both going to happen.
What about things that are like portfolio diversification, whether it's individuals running 401s or IRAs or what have you, or institutions with pension funds? I actually see, obviously, now we can have ETFs, so that just makes Bitcoin an easy button for a lot of accounts that couldn't get to it before.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are these – the yield farming shit, I'm just going to say stay away from, but it does seem like there may be something equivalent to like a certificate of deposit or money market using stables. And so it seems like these two versions of digitized assets in portfolios is going to become a mainstream thing.
Yeah, you're definitely going to see some of these instruments that pay the interest back to the holder. That is for sure coming. And it'll be like some of it. It won't be like the whole interest.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, let's say your competitor is Circle and Circle keeps all of the interest and you're Bank of America or whatever. So you issue one where 70% of the interest goes to the token holder and then you keep the 30%. Well, which one are people going to use? Well, they're going to use that one. Like they're going to come sweep the market. So that's coming. You know, Bitcoin's been more easier to buy than ever. Here's the thing. Everything that has happened, this is the best time to buy Bitcoin on a risk-adjusted basis in so many years. Why? Because you have all of this upside potential from the strategic reserve, from corporate adoption, MicroStrategy, GameStop, all these things. Huge upside potential. It's not just that. What is it? It's your downside is so reduced. That's the thing people don't realize. All of these events, you know, the chance of Bitcoin having some big crash here is reduced dramatically. So your downside is capped within reason and your upside is phenomenal. So it's, you know, I think people are seriously looking at this in portfolios right now. They're looking at this as an asset. And, you know, in the short term, the goal with Bitcoin is just more adoption, more adoption. That's what we're doing, right? You just need more people to understand it, to like it and support it. And you need to get over that adoption curve before you get into some of these like larger battles and discussions of like different tech usages, freedom, like all these things. Like that's there. My view is like that continues to grow. But like you need to just get 10 times more people owning it first. You need it to be relatively common. And then you really have a lot more landscape to push for these bills that are like, no taxes on small payments, no surveillance. Like, yeah. I want to be able to take this overseas. I want to, like, you need to fight for that, but it's hard to fight for that at a successful scale when only like 1% of the country owns this thing and they're all on Twitter. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's once you get that real kind of lots of people own it, then you have so much more. Like, imagine these senators, they're getting calls from their constituents that are saying, hey, I can't spend my Bitcoin without tracking my cost basis on every cup of coffee that I buy or everything I do, right? Right now, if you tried to push that bill, how many emails would they get? You know, 100, most of them from out of state, of just people that found out that it was happening. You know, imagine once, you know, 20% of the population owns it, completely different story, right? So that's why, you know, in this kind of period of Bitcoin adoption, I'm just focused on adoption. I'm just focused on more people owning it and understanding it to at least a basic degree.
One thing I'll say that's changed is I still have the resistant group within the group, right? But they've stopped saying shit like it's going to go to zero. It's a scam. It's vaporware. It's backed by nothing. Like, those things, you know, there's the occasional eccentric boomer. Some has to scream about it. But Peter Schiff. Anyway, but that's kind of gone. Like, so now it's like they've accepted that it's a thing. It's going to be a thing that persists. Some still are holding the, you know, the quantum bullshit. It's going to nuke Bitcoin or whatever. Not going to happen. But I still have a lot of people that won't buy a freaking single sat.
Yeah.
It drives me nuts. And I think part of it is bitterness. You know, I've been on this train since 2013 telling people to stack. Yeah. And if you didn't do it for that long and you realize what it cost you, I think maybe there is like a sour grapes thing. And I'm wondering, how do we reach that demographic? How do we get those people to understand? Like, it's not, I think they think it's too late. Right. Yeah. Like, yeah, you bought Bitcoin when it was $300 and now it's $80,000 or whatever. Like, yeah, but everything you're saying now, people were saying then too, and it was more possible then than now. Now we are a much more stable world that we're in.
Yeah, correct. No, that's right. I think there's a sense of just like, I missed it. It's hard to get in at this point. It's hard to do it. Here's the simple truth. If Americans invested 1% of their portfolios, if every American put 1% of their net worth in Bitcoin, it would trade around $1 million a coin.
Yep.
So yeah, maybe you're not going to make 1,000 times your money. Maybe you're not going to turn $100 into $1 million. But maybe you could turn $10,000 into $100,000 relatively easily. Or maybe you could turn $100,000 into $1 million, right?
Yeah.
Heck of a lot better than you're going to do in stocks or in gold or, you know, I mean, you can be upset that, hey, it could have been more. Sure. That's the case in life. It commonly is. I wish I put all my money into Bitcoin when I first discovered it. I would be enormously wealthier than I am today. Like, it could have been so much more. But guess what? Does that mean like I'm not going to buy it here in the high 80s? Of course not. I'm going to buy it here. I am buying it here. I have been buying it here. Just because I could have bought it at lower prices doesn't mean I'm not going to buy it here, because it's not about the past. It's about what do we think the future is going to hold. And my expectation for the future is that this thing can grow 10, 20, 30x in this decade, before 2030. So like, that's tremendous upside. And it's certainly more than I'm going to make buying an index fund.
I mean, you look at something like a 10x gain, and people almost don't really get how huge that is anymore because it's happened so many times. But in the money management world, if you're doubling your client's money every 7 years, you're considered a success.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
So think about that. Just if you had a compounded growth rate of about 25% over 5 years.
Yep.
That's still going to blow away almost everything else in the market. And I think that's really tamed right now. And that's how I've noticed with Bitcoin. You have these explosive moments and then new floors are established, and then it kind of just trickles around and moves back and forth for a while. And then you have your big retraction, and then it all starts all over again. And it's almost like it's run like mathematically or something. Like, there's a formula behind all of it that causes that. Have you ever really just thought about this, Steve, that $1 million Bitcoin is one penny sats? And that just seems a little perfect to me that it was planned that way all along.
I think so. I mean, these guys were talking about these things at the beginning, you know. This was an early thing. And let me address I think I understand some of why people, like, you know, you said, like, they poo-poo a 10x gain.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. I'm going to speak to this. You know, it would be great. I'm sure everyone would love, you know, hey, if you put $100,000 into this, you could have $1 million if it 10x's. And that's pretty life-changing for everybody. But most people don't have $100,000 to put in. Look, so I think that's where this conversation comes from, is like somebody only has $5,000 they can invest, or they only have $10,000 or whatever it is. And so you say, hey, you know, even if that 10X is like, okay, you got 50K, you got 100K. And it's like, that's great. But it's like, for certain people, they want to, like, they want enough money that they can retire, or they want enough, like, and that it's just simply not enough to do that. That's just a fact. You can't retire on 100K. So here's my response for these people. I understand that. Absolutely. You know what I mean? Like, it's but your chance of hitting that big home run is so low across the board. There's not, like, all of these opportunities where you're going to turn $1,000 into $1 million. Like, things promise that, it's almost never the case. And, you know, the few things that could have done that, you had to buy at a time where almost nobody understood it. You know, yeah. I mean, you know, look at what it would have taken to buy Bitcoin at $100. I mean, this was a radically different world. You wouldn't have heard of it. It would have been so complicated to buy. Like, those returns are very hard to come by. And so you need to kind of put that out of your head. So what do you do? Let's say you're somebody that you've only got $10,000 to invest. The honest answer is you need to get a little creative and figure out how to save more money. That's the simple thing. And that's something Bitcoiners push. It's not about hitting this big home run. It's about finding a way. How do I get $1,000 that I can invest in this thing every month? What would I need to do to make that happen? Because guess what? You know, after a year, that's 12 grand. And yep. It goes from there. Maybe you hit that $1,000 a month savings. Could you hit 2,000? You know what I mean? Even just at a couple $1,000s a month, those numbers start getting really big. And at a growth rate that we've seen, after 5 years, you are in a really good place, a life-changing place, where it's not just like you've got some extra cash in the bank. It's like you really have some money. And so, you know, for people that don't have a ton to invest, and I understand that, you know, everyone's got life things going on. You got family, yeah. You got work, you got kids. Maybe it's hard to find a job. I get it. But, you know, what are you going to do? Not try?
Yeah. Well, what else are you going to do with your money? That's my other thing. Like, some of these guys think they're going to buy the next meme coin or, you know, shit coin or something. And honestly, the days of the alts just raging in every cycle seem to have gone away a large degree. Like, there was a time you could just buy any new alt, sit on it for a few months and dump it. You know, if you did it at the right time in the kind of the cycle and alt season coming after the Bitcoin surge and all that, just hadn't happened. I think more and more people are snapping to the fact there's like something like a million shit coins out there. Like, there's no scarcity in this, and there's no utility in this, and there's no point to this. So there is that person that's thinking, but if I could just find the thing that I could buy $1,000 worth, yeah, and it go to $1 million. And like, some of those things, even when they look like that on paper, they're not real. I know this guy and he's worth $7 million and, you know, whatever shit coin now. I'm like, no, he's not. Cause if he tries to sell it, his one trade will tank the freaking market for this thing. There's not enough liquidity in that crap to actually maintain that price if somebody starts dumping it. Like, some dude was supposedly like a Doge billionaire or something. Go ahead and sell $1 billion worth of Doge in one day and see what happens. Yeah. See if you can actually clear it. You can't. So you don't have any other place for it to go other than the stock market, the 401k, et cetera. And I really think people need to at least take some portion of those retirement funds. And now that you have an option, needs exactly. to be in there. But exactly. I want to hear from you more about like the bigger investors, the institutional right. investors, the wealthy investors, because that's what you do at Swan. Right. You're the like head of Swan Private, which is yep. like a concierge level service. You know, last time you were on, you said there was more big money interested in Bitcoin than there ever had been. Has that continued to grow?
Absolutely. So, yeah, I did say that the last time I was on, that we were seeing record levels of interest from, you know, wealthy investors, family offices. Guess what? Bitcoin's up 100% since then. So, you know, that was a pretty good, that was a pretty good call, you know, maybe a bit more. So, yeah, I mean, that has continued to be true. In fact, you know, this is just one of these, like, you know, there's a little bit of a, you know, we're in a little bit of a sideways patch right now. But in the, like, November to January, February zone, I mean, these were record levels, record volumes, record money coming in. So many people are looking at this, corporate investors, family offices. So, yeah, I run the private wealth team for Swan. We do a very high level kind of think you're a financial advisor, but for Bitcoin, we take care of everything for wealthy investors. And I, you know, I mean, we're just talking, you know, there's just billions of dollars of incoming demand. There's tens of billions of dollars. There's a lot of money that is looking at this, that is getting in position, and that is, you know, wanting to get exposure here. I mean, and the thing is like, there's just not enough Bitcoin for every millionaire to own one Bitcoin, right? Like, ultimately, you know, people have said this for a while, but there is just a fundamental scarcity story here that will be incredibly constructive for the price.
Yeah, there's 22 million millionaires in the United States.
Yeah.
There's 21 million Bitcoin ever. There's mega entities like MicroStrategy holding over 500,000.
Sure.
You've got the U.S. government's got about 300,000, I think. You've got about 1 million Bitcoin held collectively by the ETFs. That's very long-term hold.
Yeah.
There isn't. And that's what people don't realize. I think that if you do the numbers, like, of what's actually available, there's enough for every millionaire in the United States right now who doesn't have any Bitcoin to own a third.
Yeah. That's exactly
what's there. That's what's on the exchanges. That's what's actually up for grabs. Now, the supply may increase as the price goes up. There may be people that, like, yeah, I'll sell a Bitcoin now because it's 800,000 or whatever.
But even based off the total supply, right?
Yeah, it's not there.
It's a half a coin they can have or something approximating that. So, and guess what? Like, there's people that's not going to sell. There's entities that are not going to sell. And so, like, that's always kind of the upside risk, is like, if there comes this moment where suddenly people realize they need to own Bitcoin and everyone tries to buy, there's not enough of it without, you know, very large price increases. And that's the scenario, you know what I mean? And I think if you see the U.S. starting to conduct the strategic reserve, they start making buys, a few other countries start making buys, a few more corporations like MicroStrategy and now GameStop start making buys, that's probably the signal. Like, if that doesn't kick off this moment in time where, you know, private wealth realizes they need to have this asset, I'm not sure what will. And I think it will. So, you know, we're pumping towards that, where I think your probability of one of these kind of more dramatic upside scenarios is higher than it's ever been.
Yeah, I forgot about that. It's how mundane big things are becoming. Yeah. Yesterday, I saw the announcement that GameStop is going to stack Bitcoin on their balance sheet. And that's a huge deal. That's yet another company.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's and they have a lot of cash. And if they decide to, you know, really lean into a Bitcoin strategy, you know, I mean, you know, they could do more than MicroStrategy if they wanted to. Right. So it's, you know, we're still kind of awaiting to see how serious they are with the strategy. But my take is that they are serious. Right. Like, they've done the legwork. The announcement was well received. Their stock pumped up, and all they need to do is follow through with some buys now. And I think shareholders will be rewarded, and civil management.
What are your thoughts about some of the regulatory framework popping up around the world right now? Both negative and positive. I mean, I keep hearing, you know, China and Russia are going to sell oil to each other in Bitcoin. And I've heard that like a million times. And not
I've heard that so many years. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Like, China's going to ban Bitcoin. China's going to mine all the Bitcoin. Pick one, right? But there are some things going around. And it's not all Bitcoin centric. Some of it, like any financial regulation, has a Bitcoin angle. Like, the European Central Bank says they're flat out bringing out the digital euro, which is a CBDC. in October is their timeline on that. Now, whether they actually get it done or not, we'll see. But that's their intention. That's their publicly stated intention. And, you know, that's when you look at Europe as a whole, instead of individual countries, one of the largest markets in the world.
Sure.
Right. Like that's a whole group of people now having every transaction traced. With the potential to have the European Central Bank just shut off their ability to spend money like that whenever they want to. And I do think maybe we overemphasize that threat because right now the government can totally shut down your bank account. But I guess at least we still have cash. And usually when you start having these digital currency conversations with the government, like eventually that is going to flush the cash out. So
yeah,
like how do you think all this plays in the Bitcoin space?
So I'm a little bit of a skeptic, right? So like these conversations have floated around for years. You know this as well as I do on the CBDCs, the digital systems. And even in China, it's still just a pilot program in a few provinces. It's not really used at scale, and they've been working on it for 8 years. So my take on the European thing, again, this is a test pilot. I think they're a decade out. These things are not easy to implement because I think the thing people don't realize about the CBDC systems, say goodbye to every point of sale system around the whole country. None of them work anymore. All the credit card infrastructure is gone. All the payments don't go through Visa anymore. The card companies are out of business. You're restructuring all the payroll systems, all the accounting systems. Everything needs to be overhauled. It's not just a question of like building the tech. So I'm not saying people can't do it, and I'm not saying governments won't make a push to do it, but I view it as a decade-long project. It's not something they can just snap their fingers and roll out. And they are not very far along, nor do I think they really have the talent to do it. If you actually look at the salaries that these countries are posting for their head of the CBDC program, it's like $100,000. And I know the industry.
Yeah.
There's no way you're getting like any of the top talent at those systems for that price. So I'm a skeptic. They would have to.
I know game programmers making $500,000 a year.
Correct.
With a W-2 job, by the way.
Not correct.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nothing. For build an entire new payment system for the European Union. Like, come on. No, this is a multi-billion dollar undertaking where you need the best talent in the world and they do not have it.
You also have like the biggest lobbying companies in the world representing all of those credit card companies.
Correct.
Who would stand to be written out of the payment
Correct.
Systems if that happened. I don't think people like Jamie Dimon are too hip on that.
And right? The banks, because the banks, it's like suddenly you don't need this intermediary institution to do transfers. And so
yeah.
The banks get screwed. The credit card companies get screwed. None of them want this.
Well, and maybe that's some brilliance from Trump, because if you bring the banks into stable coins, they have a piece of the pie. Where if you don't, if you just make stablecoins more accessible in the world without the banks, the banks have no real reason to not fight it, right?
Yeah.
But if they have a piece of that action all over the world, well, they're all in because they're, you know, everybody follows incentives. And the
Correct.
Only incentive a bank follows is to make more money. That's it.
Yeah. It's suddenly, if the banks can issue stablecoins, they actually start benefiting directly from Bitcoin adoption, because Bitcoin price increases and adoptions are correlated and related to directly increased stablecoin demand, because you need another instrument that can exchange with the Bitcoin in the same sort of systems. And so suddenly, like, you give those banks the stablecoin license and they're happy to see Bitcoin go up.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it would also make it more likely that we would have like legitimate Bitcoin loans, right? Like,
yeah.
Because right now, every time I'm asked about borrowing against your Bitcoin, unless it's a really like a payday loan type scenario, it's like, don't do it. Like,
no.
the Coinbase thing is something like an average interest rate of 9 to 22%,
sure.
And it changes by the minute, and you have no idea how it's going to change. But take your time, pay it back whenever you want to. Like, no, that's. But I do think that, like, when you look at Bitcoin as a form of collateral, especially if I lock it up in your bank somehow for the purpose of collateral, you have the most pristine, easily liquid collateral in the world. If I don't pay my bill, you already have my money. Correct. And you should see very low, you know, like maybe not 2% loans or something, but like something akin to a decent interest rate on a mortgage against Bitcoin, because it's better collateral. Like,
yeah,
if I loan you money to buy a house, I don't know, maybe you're an asshole. Maybe you screw the house up. Maybe when I repossess it, it's full of cockroaches. Who knows? But Bitcoin is Bitcoin. And if your Bitcoin's in my bank on a smart contract and I loan you stable coins and you don't pay me back, I don't care. I've got the money.
It's a sharp take. And few people understand this, that yes, even though the loans on Bitcoin today are, you know, more expensive, they have a higher interest rate, that shouldn't be the case. They actually should be lower, because it's exactly what you said. On these other lending scenarios, you have a much higher risk of loss on the collateral, right? Like, you do the mortgage, like you said, the bank can lose money. They can lose money on that loan. Something can go wrong with the house. Something can go wrong with the deal. It can be challenging. And so if a loan is – interest rates should be higher on loans which are more risky. And you're exactly right. These over-collateralized Bitcoin loans are basically the least risky loans on the market, because all the money's there. It's just like – you have a margin call and you're good. I know companies that do them. They have never taken a loss on a loan. And so those interest rates, like, you should have companies that are willing to do those loans basically like a little above the overnight rate, right? Because sure, ultimately there's an opportunity cost on the dollars. And that's the real thing. It's like, well, if I can make 5% lending my dollars over here, then even if it's super secure, maybe I don't want to lend it to you at 2%, right?
Sure.
But if
sure,
the overnight lending rate is 4%, I think you should have banks that want to lend against Bitcoin collateral at 4.5% or 5%. You know what I mean? And if the rate goes down, then that goes down with it.
And you damn sure want to borrow dollars against your Bitcoin. You don't want to have to pay back a Bitcoin loan in Bitcoin. We want those two worlds separate, which is where when Saylor kind of first came onto the scene and he started talking about this role for currency in the dollar and hard money in Bitcoin, there were a lot of people resistant to that. That resonated with me instantly.
Sure.
Again, and I think a big part of it is a lot of these people that are purists also don't run businesses. Like, if you ever made a payroll before, like, I used to run a company, we made payroll weekly for 2,500 people. Like, you cannot introduce that volatility into that payroll scheme. And like, it always works out over time. Yeah, but you see, when I got a guy working in the Philippines who doesn't get paid on Thursday and he quits on me and I lose my contract, I can't do that.
Exactly.
And so as soon as you actually have to run either inventory or payroll, I think that duality model makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's advantageous, right? Like, having you're basically describing having your liabilities in US dollars while having your savings in Bitcoin. That's beautiful. Why? Because your dollar liabilities decrease over time and your savings increase over time. I'm perfectly happy to sit in that system for quite some time. That's a good system for people that own Bitcoin and spend dollars.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I don't think that changes anytime soon. Like, you know, I know there's a lot of people out there that are, you know, really want to see like, yeah, Bitcoin's all the currency in the world. But I think that we're nowhere near that. Even if we are getting close to Bitcoin playing a substantial role in the financial system, I think we are close to that. But it will be a two-tier system. There will exist Bitcoin and there will exist dollars, same as it always has been. And smart actors will spend and have your liabilities in dollars while saving in Bitcoin.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, why do people who could buy a house take out a mortgage? Right? They could write a check, but I can do more with my money than it costs me to have, you know, like, I bought years ago, so I have like a 2.95% interest rate on my house. I could write a check tomorrow and pay off the last of the mortgage. I'm not going to do that because I can do more with that. I'd rather have that money just sit in Bitcoin than pay off a mortgage at 3%.
Yeah.
It also keeps me from moving. We talk about moving once in a while. Like, we ain't moving. I can buy half the house and pay just as much. Like, no, I ain't going nowhere in this.
Exactly. Area. You know, when you get those kind of lower mortgages, you're kind of locked in. I'm in a similar spot. I've got like a same rate sort of mortgage. I, you know, bought a home in early mid 2021, and it was those fantastic interest rates. And yeah, why did I not pay cash? Because I was able to invest the rest of that cash in Bitcoin, and it's up hundreds of percent, you know, and actually the interest rate on that mortgage is lower than inflation. It's like getting paid off for me. I'm never going to pay that thing off any faster than I need to, because it's just advantageous. You have the option for that system right now. Like you take your debt in dollars, you keep your savings in Bitcoin, and it looks really good over time.
Is there, as we go back more toward, you know, your wheelhouse of the higher net worth investor, is there a trend of investors seeking exposure? Like, yes, some are buying Bitcoin, but they're just in general looking for things other than stocks and bonds.
No, so it's more they're looking for Bitcoin. So it really is, I think there is this Bitcoin story that's in the world right now, and there are quite a few investors that are realizing, oh, wow, like I need to figure this out. I want to own some Bitcoin. I'm interested in this asset. And they're specifically pursuing the Bitcoin story. And, you know, like I said, that has been a steady increasing trend for the last year and a half in a material pace.
Yeah, I would guess that there's institutions overseas, too, that are looking at this because, you know, we kind of talked about, like, if you're a peasant in Vietnam and you're earning and spending dong, it's not a great position to be in. But if you're a company in Vietnam and you're being paid in dong and your reserves are in dong, that's really bad. And if you can hold dollars, that's better, but you're still bleeding at somewhere between 8% and 12% right now. Yeah. And that's not sustainable either. So are there, you know, international institutions that are looking to at least move some of their reserve capital? Because that's what it kind of like. Sweep that surplus capital over just seems to be the smart model.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, you increasingly see that. I mean, there is, you know, there's massive cycles of capital flows in this world. We live in a very broad global economy, and, you know, smart corporate operators and wealthy investors are constantly figuring out how to take advantage of that, you know, where to push their money, how to hold their money. And I think Bitcoin becomes a key part of that here this year.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think the long-term role of digital assets in general are in the world of finance? Like, will we see more instruments that use them or incorporate them, or more companies maybe say moving money overseas or in between countries or even in between branches? You know, if not using Bitcoins, using stable coins and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, 100%, right? You're going to see that. We're already seeing that, really. So you've seen, I think MicroStrategy was the first pass at this. They have made so many different products and basically Bitcoin-denominated or Bitcoin-linked financial products. That could be their convertible bonds. That can be their preferred shares. That could be all of these interesting capital strategies that they're working on. And now there are other companies that are doing that. There are ETFs that are bundling up those bonds and securities, and you're only going to see more of that. You're only going to see more of that. You're only going to see these firms. So Strive is Vivek's asset management company, right? So he has ETF issuer. And Matt Cole, the CEO, he's on Twitter every day talking about these strategies for Bitcoin-linked financial products. So that's coming in a big way. I'd be shocked if you don't have 10 times more of it this year. I'd be shocked if there isn't like a huge amount of this. And I would also be surprised if the financial industry doesn't find some pretty unique and interesting ways to leverage the property of Bitcoin to build other products. That's what MicroStrategy has done. If when people really get it, they have basically extracted the volatility and converted that into a financial product for different classes of investor. They have basically taken the asset, they've broken out the returns from the volatility, from these other components, and they've securitized it in very brilliant ways. And like I said, just there's going to be more of this, and you're going to have a lot of attention on this this year.
Do you see more than mainstream integration as, like, we have this evolving economic landscape developing?
We do. I mean, definitely. I mean, we're living through, like, if you look at the administration and you look at the voices and the commentary that's coming out of the Trump administration, you see a huge focus on reordering global trade in the financial system. They have sweeping ambitions, and this is you know, just what's going on with all of these trade discussions and all of these currency discussions, the debt. You have people really taking a look at the entire structure of the economic system and asking the question, like, can this be better? Can we have better trade deals? Can we have a better currency dynamic? Can we reshore manufacturing? Can we have more industrial jobs? Can we pay less of a price for the U.S.'s role in the world? Does Bitcoin have a role in that? Is Bitcoin useful to the U.S.? Should the U.S. have a sovereign wealth fund? Should we be investing in assets to try to pay down the debt? Right? These are conversations that are very alive right now, and I think will continue to be for at least, you know, this 4 years.
What about, like, now we're starting to hear states, like,
yes,
lowercase s, like Texas, I think Arizona, Florida, and there's one other that all look fairly likely to actually do this. Texas is this close. I'm hoping we beat Florida to something, you know, because our governor, I refer to him as 2 months after DeSantis, because that started with COVID. Like, yeah, Ron would, like, close something down and stop some of the nonsense, and, like, 2 months later, Greg would do it. But it looks like we might actually beat Florida to a Bitcoin reserve.
As much as I'd love to win, I hope you do. I hope somebody just gets there first. And I think there's a lot of momentum there. So, you know, would love to see it. And yeah, I mean, I think all of these things are on the table. We're really just in this, like, short lull, I think, that, you know, in a couple months you'll look back on as the calm before the storm.
Well, what, not long ago, Bitcoin was 14 grand, right? I mean, like, I think we get spoiled in this space. We get used to, like, you know, waking up every day 4% richer than we were the day before during that bull run, you know, and then having one big green candle that's like, you know, a 27% in one day. And, like, that's just not realistic. If it did continue like that, I would start to actually get worried. Like, that's not how real commodities roll.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's
correct. But I think the state thing is bigger than people realize. Like, we have states in this country that have more money than most other countries in the world. I mean, Texas, Florida, and California's not going to do it anytime soon, but these are states that are, you know, equivalent to, like, the 10th or 11th largest economies in the world if they were nations.
Correct.
It's a lot bigger of a deal than, let's say, El Salvador doing it. If Texas can buy a hell of a lot more Bitcoin than El Salvador, I guess is what I'm saying.
It's a great point. No, it's a great point. Some of these states have the ability to buy much more than many countries that might be looking at this, right? You know, on that level, I mean, I'm looking at the U.S., I'm looking at U.S. states, and I'm looking at the Middle East as the real targets for people that are going to move on this. I think you see big moves out of the UAE. They already have. They already own billions of Bitcoin. I think they're going to buy more.
I would say Saudi sooner or later.
Correct. Yeah.
Just with what they're doing, like with the line in the desert, and they're trying to create this massive business hub and be that network there. At some point, you know, you have that much reserve capital, and it's getting eaten no matter what currency. Like, there isn't. I guess if you don't understand, there isn't a currency in the world that's, you know, a nation state currency that's not subject to inflation. And probably the best, if you don't like the dollar, the sad thing to tell you is it's probably the best or close to the best one you could be holding.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it like, people don't realize, you know, it's the cleanest dirty shirt. The dollar as a fiat currency compared to other fiat currencies is so much better than the others. But,
yeah,
you know, it's these oil states, these Middle Eastern oil states, they're in a unique position where basically, like, they don't have very modern economies. They don't produce a lot of technology. They're limited in terms of resources. They can't grow a lot of food. And all they have is effectively huge oil revenues. And so what these countries realized is they needed to invest. They needed to take their economic surplus and they needed to make returns on that. That's something the U.S. has never tried to do. And so they are very versed in the language of a sovereign wealth fund. And they are very versed in the idea that they need to take the money they make selling oil and they need to convert that into assets that yield a return. And so Bitcoin's a natural fit for them, as well as, you know, then the ability to reinvest that capital into mining infrastructure and data centers and AI infrastructure. And like, this is what you're going to see out of the Middle East.
No, that makes sense. I mean, just the flare gas they probably have alone is insane. I start thinking about all these flare gas mining operations we have going on here in Texas, and what could I be doing in Saudi Arabia with that? It's also the case that a lot of these Middle Eastern countries are very much welfare states. A lot of that oil money is put in endowments and then used to pay out various forms of welfare. Maybe not things that people would directly recognize because they're government services, but that's welfare. Right. And, you know, you have these countries as things keep changing with energy, and that's the only thing they have. Yeah. And then, you know, they're holding a currency that they're self-inflating away the value of. And they have the, you know, unfunded liabilities, just like we do, that they have got to be thinking to the future about. Because when you take away welfare from people who have been receiving it for generations, they tend to get mad. And then they go to the place that the leaders are and they pull the leaders out in the street and they hang them from light poles. Right. It's cutting off welfare causes riots. And when people starve, it causes like the death of the people that run the place. Like that's the one thing through history. If you look back, every time you got to the point where like it was just drag all the leaders in the street and murder them, it's when people were starving.
Sure.
So that's something governments have learned. And in this case, it's all about money. That's how it will be sustained, because they don't, like you said, they don't have the resources anyway. They're going to feed their people. They have to bring in the food. And Saudi's trying really hard to grow like wheat in the desert and all. And they've had some limited successes, but they're never going to feed themselves. They're just not going to do it. You know, I mean, I remember Saylor said something about, you know, how much wealth it would take to have 100 palm trees in the middle of the Sahara Desert.
Yeah.
And it's like $1 billion just to have 100 palm trees because there's no water there.
You saw Dune, right?
Yeah.
When they're watering the palm trees, you know what I mean? It's this enormous riches. It's they're spending billions to, you know, equivalently, it's just like water trees. No, that's right. You know, and that's why they need to steward their capital intelligently. And, you know, they're going to need to invest in digital technology. I mean, that's the thing. They need to own digital capital that can provide economic returns and values to those nations as oil revenue declines, which it will at some point. I'm not saying that's tomorrow. And I'm not saying, you know, I mean, but it either runs out or you switch to a different energy technology, whatever that may be. It could be nuclear. It could be whatever. But like there will come a day someday where they need something else. And so they need to prepare for that transition ahead of time. And it's not just like a Bitcoin story. I think they're going to be huge investments in AI. I think that's a lifeline for them. I think they're going to have data centers they're going to run. They're going to do huge hosting facilities, start invest in their own technology. But like this is the play. They have to take a very different economic trajectory than a country like the U.S.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Let's take some questions from the audience and get toward wrapping up here.
Awesome.
229 Mix says, could you discuss UTXO management in Bitcoin dust and how to avoid it? And it's on you, Steve. I've done this 1,000 times.
Yeah. So let's keep this super simple, right? You do not want to have what is called UTXOs. These are just, I don't even want to explain what they are. You don't want to have these things that are too small. How do you get them small? It's when you do a withdrawal. It must be a withdrawal or a transaction that is only for like $10 or $50. Whatever you withdraw or transact with, you will then have a UTXO that is effectively that size. Basically, the issue is that over time, fees will go up. And if you have a bunch of $10 units, you might have to pay a dollar to move each one. And that's a 10% fee. It's exorbitantly expensive, right? So how do you solve this simply? Do not withdraw from exchanges in $50 increments. So don't do it where like every time you've got $50 on Swan or Strike or Cash App or wherever, you withdraw it to your wallet. That's how you get small UTXOs. You need to wait until you've got $500, then you withdraw it. That's simple. As long as you don't withdraw, do these tiny buys and withdraw them each time, you're fine. Yeah. And if you do have this problem, then you need to wait until the fees are very low and you need to consolidate them all. You need to basically send like a bunch of, like you have to take them all, take your whole balance in the wallet and make one new transaction to a new wallet you control, right? So that's the, just that's basically it.
And it's the reason I think I have to say this so much is I've noticed a long time and way, way back in the day when we didn't really worry about the fees very much because they were minuscule, we all told people what? New transaction, new address. And it was a security measure because let's say I'm selling stuff on my website even, and I'm not even trying to hide from government or anything. And all of a sudden, just because you can see all the transactions, my competitors know exactly how much money I'm making. And they also know probably what I'm selling the most of because they can price match out of my catalog, just things like that. Or, you know, if someone sends you some Bitcoin and then goes, oh, look, Steve has $9 million worth of Bitcoin. Steve might wake up with a gun in his mouth, right? I mean, like, so there was a security issue there, but there is kind of like this new world. And my threshold's a grand. $1,000, that's when I withdraw.
And yep, exactly.
It's pretty simple from that point forward. Zukunzi says, I'm interested in hearing your Masterlink opinion. We kind of did that. I don't know if you want to add anything to it, though. Like, do you think it is a good strategy? I do.
Yeah. So I love MicroStrategy. I have no problems with MicroStrategy. Here's the thing you need to understand.
I'm sorry.
What?
Yeah, MicroStrategy. I said MasterLink. I used to work for a company called MasterLink, and sometimes
I get it. Right. So MicroStrategy, think of it like this. That's not Michael Saylor owning 2.4% of the Bitcoin supply. That's 300,000 shareholders owning 2.4% of the Bitcoin supply. It's many, many people's Bitcoin. Yes, there's some additional component that he could take certain actions or the company could, but it's the same as the ETF. It's not that BlackRock has, you know, so many. It's that millions of individual shareholders do. It's the same as like, you know, you're going to see custodial consolidation in these ways, right? Like that's just something that's going to happen. It's not really a vulnerability to the system. Like obviously things can get a little weird at like very extreme levels, but it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
MicroStrategy is not going to have 20% of the supply. So I think it's brilliant what he's done. I think it's been very beneficial for Bitcoin. I think other countries are going to do it and, I think it'll be great.
Yeah. Yeah. We got a question here on stable coins, and I think I know what Tommy's asking. What percentage of worldwide stable coins are USD? So there are stable coins like Euro and stuff like that. Like,
yeah.
What's the dominance of the dollar in that?
It's all USD, 99.x%. Okay. It's like minuscule, these other currencies.
Same guy says, what's the lowest interest rate currently available on a Bitcoin loan? Like I said, the Coinbase system's like 9 to 22%, and it changes by the minute. So it's all bad. There's no good. I mean, 9 would be high for me if it was locked at 9.
Yeah, there are ways to do it. So I think the lowest you're going to get is kind of in that 10%, 9 to 10%. You can get that locked. You know, we have some lending partners that do this stuff, but you know, it's definitely more expensive than like a mortgage or something.
Yeah, yeah. I had another thing, and I can't think of what it was now. That it come to me while you were talking. Well, maybe it'll pop up because we're almost done. I just want to ask you, like, last time you were on, we talked about Bitcoin, but we also talked about a lot of stuff with health and what have you, and lighting and stuff like that. Have you discovered anything new in that world? Because I found that really interesting. I think there is a huge overlap between, like, Bitcoin bros and gym bros, right? Like
100%.
Like there's just like, I think what it is it something pulls at the thread, right? So a person finds Bitcoin and then they realize like, so you don't need government to make money. You actually can have an independent system that's truly independent, that truly makes money. And then they say, well, what else have I been lied to about? And if you pull on the food thread, then all kinds of shit comes out. And as soon as you fix that, then you feel better. So now you want to be physically active.
Correct. Yeah. So I'm a big sunlight and circadian health component, also, you know, movement, gym, all you know, weightlifting, walking. So what I'm really well known for in the Bitcoin world, I walk like 10 miles a day. So I'm a huge walker. I walk like an enormous amount, also love to lift weights. And I think that sunlight, is essential for health. Enormous research to back this up. I've written essays on the topic. And surprisingly, what most people don't understand at first glance is I'm not as much talking about sun on your skin. There are benefits to that, vitamin D. I'm actually talking about light in your eyes. It's actually seeing light.
Mm-hmm.
Has such a systemic health impact that if you're staying inside all day, you have bright white lights on at night till 2 a.m., this is having a profound impact on your system. So what are the basic principles? You know, I think people know this one because the Huberman Labs has gotten very popular, but see the sunrise, see the sun when you first get up, get outside, no sunglasses, 20, 30 minutes. You need to see the light. It'll set your whole system for the day. Get as much as you can during the day. And at night, you need to be dimming the lights. You need to be bringing the lights down. You need some soft amber, even red people do, but like you need much more red shifted amber lights at night. You don't want bright white overhead. You don't want all this stuff going on. Your body needs to have that dark shift. And this will impact your physical health, your mind, your cognition, how well you sleep, how well you function. It touches everything. And I know very few people that, you know, effectively did this for, you know, for a month and didn't notice significant differences.
What about your diet? What are you? Are you heavy carnivore diet or?
You know, I'm actually not. I'm not heavy carnivore, but you know, I just think it's, you know, it's whole foods. It's just not a lot of processed junk. I mean, I eat plenty of fruit and I eat plenty of like, you know, white rice and stuff. And like I'm in the gym regularly, and I mean, I perform better. I mean, just, and I think most people do. I mean, having some carbs before like heavy weightlifting is a must. In my opinion, I mean, if that's not your experience, then you know, great. But I think a lot of people report that. I also think it's like there's different ancestries. You know, people come from different human populations and different diets, and also different environments, right? So like in the winter up north, there really aren't much carbs. You know what I mean? Like it's hard to find carbs, so people eat meat all winter because that's the environment. If you live in tropical Florida, guess what? Fruit grows here year round. And so there's this almost this relationship between sunlight and carbs.
Yeah.
When there is sunlight, there are carbs. When there is not sunlight, there are not carbs. And this actually comes out in like how our bodies digest these systems. So I actually think when you're in a high sunlight environment, you have a higher carb tolerance. And if you're in a low sunlight environment, this could either be where you live or it could be how you live.
How you live. Sure. Sure.
You know what I mean? So I think there's a lot of people that don't get much sunlight at all and they notice they feel better on a carnivore diet. That makes sense in many ways. But there could also be a way where like if you get those circadian signals going, you might tolerate carbs better.
Yeah, I think that's valid. I do think ancestry plays a role. I'm a type O blood type. It's like a caveman, Cro-Magnon freaking blood type. And it's also very like kind of a Nordic blood type as well, right? So it's more northern latitude, historical bloodline. And I also say, I've said this for years, even though I try to stay fairly ketogenic with my diet, I'm not carnivore, but I do eat very low carbohydrate. Yeah. Like, first of all, I train wrecked my life in my 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
I got successful and I abused food. So then there's like, then you have to take radical corrective measures. So that's, you know, one part of it. But then the other side of it is like, I remember the 80s and I remember going to the beach and there was no fat people, right?
Yes.
Like, you know, like if one fat person stood out, you know, and the person we called fat back then, today you wouldn't even notice. So I think there's definitely been a change. I think you're right about the lighting. That's a big piece of it. Sleep patterns. But it's also like, is it carbs or is it garbage? Because like what happens to a person that goes carnivore is they're not eating Cheetos.
Correct.
They're not eating Lay's. They're not eating Fritos. They're not eating Oreos. They're not eating gummy bears. Right.
Correct. So
by eliminating everything, you're eliminating the definite bad things.
Absolutely. No, that's a huge part of it. It's like what happens on these diets is it's also an elimination diet. And so it's just a strict way that people cut out the junk. And that's what I'm saying. There's a big difference between gummy bears and mangoes or apples or whatever. And then like that's just the thing I would like, you know, like our ancestors have been at eating at least seasonal carbohydrates as far back. You walk by a tree with some apples on it, you're eating the apples.
You're eating
apples. There's a huge difference between that and Cheetos and gummy bears and, you know, other things, you know.
I think separation plays a role in it too, though, because like if you are in a time that there's lots of carbs available in nature, there's probably not a lot of fat and protein. And when you have a lot of fat and protein, you don't have a lot of carbs. There's a seasonality to that flow, especially like you're at the subtropics, right? Like as soon as you move out of the subtropics into temperate climate, you just, you know, if you don't have fig trees, you don't have sugar year round. And absolutely. So when you look at like when the bears come out of hibernation, all the fat's off, there's like tons of berries and stuff like that. But by the time the salmon are really flowing, we've gotten past that. So now we're on to a protein fat. And I think that humans evolved, obviously, over thousands and thousands of years. And I think we evolved in that kind of cycle. We also evolved in a cycle of not always having food, like right. actually going for periods of time and being hungry. That is a normal human condition. And that, you know, in the age of the Piggly Wiggly and the Kroger, that's not the case anymore. If you want gummy worms at 2 a.m. and you have money, you don't even have to leave the house. Somebody will bring it to you, right? So, like, we live in a different world from nature, and I think that's why the light thing is the same type of thing. We created this artificial environment, and if you want to see obese animals, go to a zoo, right? That you don't see obese animals in nature, including very well-fed predators, or, like, you see, like you'd say an elephant's fat. Well, it's not fat for an elephant, right? This is not – if you find an obese animal, it's either in a zoo, living in somebody's house, or it's eating our garbage.
Correct.
That's where you find it.
You actually made a really interesting point, too, because there's research on this that effectively this is the thing. As long as you don't combine carbs and fat, you're fine. Yeah. You can do carbs and protein. You can do protein and fat. You can do carbs alone. You can do fat alone. But there is a suddenly when you're eating high carb and high fat meals, it has a very different impact on the body. Yeah. And so this is, I'm not even saying as like, I just mean like separating them as meals. And when you,
I agree. That's what I'm saying.
A ton of the food, a ton of the like really addictive food stuff. It's all carbs and fat. It's sugars and fat. It's combining them and it tastes great. But, that's where you get into, you know, your body has a carb burning pathway and your body has a fat burning pathway. And when you smash them together at the same time, you get a surplus.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, then the body has to make decisions about what to get rid of first, and it's going to get rid of the carbs first because it's going to spike your blood sugar, and if that stays around long enough, it'll kill you. So it has to do that first, so you end up with this huge caloric hit coming up in the back end of things. It, like, there's a lot of processes like that. Like, people think they can drink and lose weight. You're not really, and I mean, I drink here and there, fine, but I'm, you know, drinking daily or whatever, like, you're not, because your liver can only process either sugar or alcohol. And the alcohol goes first because it'll kill you quicker. So all that sugar is just staying in your bloodstream until it clears. You want to kill yourself, cranberry juice and vodka, screwdrivers, drinks like that. That's how to kill yourself. Like, it's very textbook how to do it. And hey, we're a little off of the Bitcoin topic, but I just want to ask you about some of the stuff you're doing, because you know, you did bring a lot of that up last time, and I found it really interesting. And I do think it's very common in the Bitcoin space. Like, you get in the world of real money, then you want real food, you want real lifestyle, you want real environment, you know, you want real relationships. And I think it is the orange pill, that it is the truth pill. It you find reality. And once you find reality, it's kind of like, well, this is cool. I don't think this is real then, right? So now I have to find the truth about all these things, and it becomes like this truth-seeking movement. And it does seem like, I would say, the vast majority of people I know that are, you know, not own a little bit of Bitcoin, but they're serious about it. They pay attention to it. They stack consistently, et cetera. They seem to eventually find that their way there as well.
Absolutely. Very true.
Well, hey, if you want to get started buying Bitcoin with Swan – Steve. How do they do that?
Yeah, just go to swan.com. You can sign up on the site. If you're looking for a private client team, think buying, you know, at least 50 to 100K. That's swan.com/private. You get on the phone with me, you get on the phone with the team, we'll walk you through every step of the process and you'll get the best service in the industry. So, you know, but both options are available. You can do a retail account on swan.com. You can go to the private client. Just reach out. We're here to talk. We're here to help and be part of the Bitcoin journey.
And for the people that aren't the $50,000 and up client that are going to go on that retail side, can you give them, like, you know, minimum buys or you know, like what is the process like?
Oh, yeah.
I love what you guys do because, like, you're going to even automate with, for like every time you hit $1,000, it'll just auto withdraw for you. I mean, you have some great tools.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We have automated weekly purchases, you know, as little as $10 a day. I think the minimum buy is like 10 or 20 bucks. So it's really a great and easy stacking platform. You sign up, it'll take 60 seconds. You can do one-time buys. You can do, hey, I want to buy $50 a week, every week, automatically from the bank account. Once that crosses $500, automatically withdraw it to my wallet. So it's got all there. It's a great suite of services. You know, we got great content for our clients. So, you know, feel free to just come up and check it out.
Yeah. And one thing I love about Swan is you guys encourage self-custody. Not many exchanges seem to do that. And it seems like all the ones that do that, they have one commonality. They're all Bitcoin only.
Correct.
Funny that, right?
Yeah. Very few crypto exchanges encourage self-custody.
Do you think that at least some of the players in the shitcoin casinos, like, maybe don't have enough to cover everything if everything was, you know, withdrawn on one day? Because I don't have any proof of that, but everything in my gut tells me that if, you know, everybody on shitcoin exchange XYZ just decided in one day I'm done and I want out, I don't know that there's enough to cover it.
Yeah. I don't know. We'll see one day. You know what I mean? It's the thing is it's tricky with a lot of the crypto because there's usually a lot of issuance going on. That's the difference. It's like, you know, banks can never run out of dollars because they make more of them. And I think that's the case with a lot of these crypto things. With Bitcoin, the supply is fixed. So it's much more sensitive. But with some of these coins, that might not be the case.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know that they would be short on Bitcoin because what they could do is, you know, they take shitcoin casino coin that is their own coin and they can issue and sell enough of it to cover the spread, even if they didn't have it immediately. I would say that that's potential. But I just say this to everybody. If you self-custody, you don't care about this. It's really, really simple. If you self-custody, you're not worried about whether or not you can get your stuff off the exchange. And I'll just say real quick here as we end with that, don't get all wound up. Like we talked about not withdrawing small amounts. Don't get all wound up that you have $200 on Coinbase or, you know, even Swan or Strike or whoever. Like that's not what we mean. We're talking about people like have, you know, significant holdings, $10, $20, $50, $100,000, and it's all sitting on an exchange somewhere. And at least with Swan, if I have a problem, I can contact you and like somebody will talk to me. Like try using Coinbase customer service. It's, I don't know that there actually is a customer service there. I don't want to just dog shit on somebody, but really like the number of people I've heard from, like I have a, you know, transaction pending for 3 days that won't come out or whatever. And like, I've never had that problem using them, but I know it's happened to other people. And like, well, what happened when you contacted customer service and the response is nothing, you know? So I will tell you guys, if you use Swan, you're not going to have that problem. There's real people there that really care about you as a customer. So, hey, Steven, I know we got preempted once before, but we got this done. Thanks for coming on the show again.
Oh, thank you for having me, man. It's a pleasure to be on. Always is. And great talking with all you guys.
Thanks, man.
See you.
All right, guys, real quick before we wrap up, I want to remind you one of the ways you can help support this show and the work that we do is do your online shopping where tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. You do that, you'll help us out no matter what you eventually buy. I've got kind of a bigger ticket item for you guys today, but it's on a stupid cheap sale price relative to the retail anyway. The TP-Link Deco AXE5400 tri-band mesh router system. Okay, that's a mouthful. But what this is it basically replaces your Wi-Fi router where your connection comes in from outside. And so you plug one of them in and it becomes the router. The other ones can then be distributed throughout your home as wireless hotspots is a way to think of it. But they're all the same network. They're a device on the same network, which means if you have a big home or maybe you put one out on your back porch or whatever, when you go from one to the next, there is a completely seamless handoff. You'll never notice it. And this system is freaking robust. So I used to run a fairly good Linksys system here that I never had problems with as long as it was just me and some friends over. But when I do workshops and I have, you know, 80 people here pounding the network, it would really cause problems. And I installed this about 2 years ago, and we used to turn off the guest network during live streams because we had intermittent problems and things like that, live streaming out all of the events. We put this in, and I would forget to do it, and it didn't matter. This thing is just bulletproof, and it's super easy to install. The three-unit system, so you got one acting as your router. It's also a wireless point, but you got two others, and they can either be connected wireless backbone back to the main unit, or if you have a place you've run data cabling, you can have a piece of Cat 6 plugged into it, which I do out in my garage. I have a Cat 6 line that runs from behind me here all the way down the side of the house into the garage because it's a metal frame garage, and we had signal issues out there. And either way, it just works seamlessly. And once you set it up and configure it, it just works. And then the app that comes with it, you can use it on your phone, check your network. If you got somebody on your network you don't want there anymore, or setting priority, it makes you, it kind of lets you be like a network administrator without having to know how to be a network administrator. It's a really great system, and it's on Renewed today, right? So it's on Renewed for $199. So $200 for a $350 system. If you've never heard me talk about the Amazon Renewed program before, it is fantastic. And not just for this. I bought a DeWalt chainsaw today on Renewed. And there was only three of them for sale. And I put it on Telegram. I didn't even put it on the website because I knew it had three available. And I bought one. It wasn't going to last. And I put it on the TG list. And like 5 minutes later, Tim Nye came back and said, and it's gone. And they were gone. That was a $50 savings. I've been wanting to pick one of those up since I tried J.R. Haley's. So the Amazon Renewed program, again, it's like this hidden gem. What you think it means is, you know, you bought a thing on Amazon and it broke, so you sent it back under warranty, and then like some shop somewhere and people are slaughtering things back. That is not how that program works. It is anything that was returned for any reason, including, nah, I just don't want it now. Including it arrived 2 days late, so now I don't want it because I'm returning it because my wife yelled at me. And things like that. So the Renewed program itself, when you go to tspaz.com, one of the links there, in addition to all the category reviews, is just to the Renewed store. So I really recommend whenever you're buying something that's more than a few bucks, just check Renewed. Usually it has a shorter warranty of 90 days. But if you really want longer warranties, you can buy extended warranties on electronic products. I'm not really worried about that in most instances, but it is all top-end stuff. And the way this came about is Amazon is a data-driven company. And what they had traditionally done with their returns, they just threw them all on pallets, and they sold the whole pallet sight unseen. And they say it has a retail value of $10,000, and we're selling it for $1,500 or $2,000. And people would buy it, and then they would go resell that stuff. And it was kind of a gamble because you didn't know what you were going to get or what condition it was in, but they'd sell it on eBay. They'd sell it on Craigslist. They'd sell it in Facebook Marketplace. Some people are shop owners, put it in their own shop. But the number one thing people did with it, they put it right back on Amazon as a third-party vendor as a used product. Well, Amazon analyzed this. They figured out the stuff that always sells well, and now instead of selling the pallets with everything, they cherry-pick DeWalt, Milwaukee, in the kitchen world, like KitchenAid, Ninja, like that's the stuff that's there, and it's because they know it will sell. So when you're buying like a high-end name brand electronic, computer product, kitchen tool, power tool, always check. Sometimes you'll find it's $10 different, and you'd rather have the two-year warranty than a 90-day warranty. Yeah, fine. when you start looking $50 here, $100 there, some of you were thinking, where am I going to get some money? Where am I going to get some money to buy all this Bitcoin from? Start by saving money, and then maybe you'll have some more money to spend. 229 Mix says, do you have a TSPAS link direct to Renewed? TSPAS.com. Go there. Scroll down. You'll see a link to Vivor. You'll see a link to Amazon. Just use those links. You'll see the Amazon Renewed store. You'll see the Amazon outlet. And one other thing, I just don't remember what it is right now. But you'll see one other option there available to you. I make it all easy, all in one place. Save yourself some money because there are some really great options to save money if you use some of these alternative things. So, again, I'm just looking real quick. The outlet program, the Renewed store, along with all the reviews, items of the day, everything like that. The outlet's a pretty good deal, too. Sometimes they just have things on like special deals and whatever they put into the outlet or things that they're clearing out. Again, the more money you save, the more money you have, the more money you have, the more money you can invest in your future with that long time preference. If you're not excited about Bitcoin, you haven't learned enough about Bitcoin yet. I know it's one of my least favorite subjects among the audience, but I'm seeing the numbers shift as people are beginning to snap to it. You live in a day and age where every dollar you hold is being eroded in value on a daily basis forever. The dollar is what's going to zero. It's just they can keep making more and more dollars. So, you know, a fraction of a little bit above zero seems like it's still something. Bitcoin is going to have volatility. It's going to go up and down, guys. But there is nothing you can do to ensure your long-term wealth better right now than buying Bitcoin. And DCA is the way. Dollar cost average every day if you can swing it. If you don't buy enough in one go, to use Swan, who was, you know, great with us and came on today to do a daily DCA. Strike, you can DCA a dollar a day, $1 a day, $7 a week, $28 a month to $31 a month, depending on what month it is. I do $5 a day on Strike. No matter what else I buy, $5 a day. And I will tell you, I did the research. When was the worst time to do a lump sum buy of Bitcoin measured over 5 years? Sometime in 2017, if I remember right. And then I used AI and I said, what would have happened if I took, say, $50,000 and bought it then, and I would have basically lost money over 5 years? It has actually happened that one time with that big spike and some other things going on. I said, if I took that money and I DCA'd monthly, it was 197% return in the same period of time. DCA is powerful because you're averaging things out. That's the whole point. And the higher the frequency, the more that is magnified. And people have gone through it over and over again. The DCA investor wins the race in this market. Anyway, with that, take care. I'll be back tomorrow with an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. Better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.